maybe talk a similar theme, but in all, from a different aspect. So if you were here a couple of weeks ago, the main verse for the morning was trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding, and in all your ways acknowledge him or submit to him, and he'll make your path straight. And I gave some examples how people did things that actually were totally illogical, but God told them to do it. And I wanted to, in some ways, build on that, but from a slightly different angle. Jan and I do a kind of a Bible reading program, and a couple of weeks ago, a verse from Ecclesiastes struck me, as it had several years ago. And I knew that about 9 years ago, I preached on this verse. So I have to be honest with you, I looked up what I'd said then, and I've kind of developed on that, but in line with trusting in God with all your heart. Desmond Tutu, most of you might know him, some of you might never have heard of him, but he was a great leader in South Africa of the church through the apartheid age. And he said this, he said that true freedom and liberation comes when the oppressed are no longer oppressed and the oppressor no longer oppresses. No more oppressed and no more oppressors. And this is the first from Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 1, and it says this, "Again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter." And it's a strange thing, isn't it? It's like God looks at the oppressed and the oppressor and sees that both have no comforter. With that above reading in mind, I want to talk about two very well-known parables this morning. And in the first one, Jesus heals a man who is being oppressed. And in the second, Jesus extends love to an oppressor. I want to look at how people reacted to that. So both these accounts take place in Jericho, or more precisely, entering Jericho and leaving Jericho. The likelihood is that this was the same day and these two events happened then. In the 4th century, apparently the Greek divisions of chapters, etc., came in. And for some reason, they separated these two stories by a chapter division. But actually, from what I've read and seen, you can call this and believe it is the same day. I mean, it don't really matter whether it isn't, is or isn't, but it just seems that it could be the same day that this is taking place. No one would disagree, I don't think, that the Bible speaks on the behalf of the oppressed, the widow, the poor, those in prison, the orphaned. I don't think any of us would doubt that. So does it show that God is on the side of the oppressed? And I think, yes, it does. And I think we could rightly say that. He's concerned about the marginalized of society, those that are excluded. And he comes to show them compassion. Wasn't that what Jesus was known for? Look who he mixes with. Look what he does. But what does the Bible say about the oppressor? What does it say about him? Surely he must be opposed, exposed for what he's doing. Isn't that what should happen? Isn't that the natural assumption? Oppressors need to be shown up for what they are and dealt with and lift up the oppressed. So let's look at these two stories. The first story takes place, and we can read this in Luke chapter 18, verses 35 to 43. Jesus is approaching Jericho, and a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening, and they told him, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." He called out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Those who led the way rebuked him, told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "David, or Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and ordered the man to be brought to him. And when he came near, Jesus asked him, "What do you want me to do for you?" "Lord, I want to see," he replied. Jesus said to him, "Receive your sight, your faith has healed you." And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. And when all the people saw it, they also praised God. So the story opens with a blind beggar by the roadside, outside the city, as Jesus is coming in. There's a guy called Kenneth Bailey, and he spent 40 years in the Middle East, and he kind of did comparisons. He worked in seminaries there, and some of the culture that was around at the time of Jesus is quite a lot of writings, not just from the Bible, but secular writings, that they can find out what culture was like. And some of what I'm going to say does come from his understanding. But I think it seems to fit quite well, because we don't always understand how people thought at that time, or what their culture was at that time, or what their expectations were. But in the Middle East, village and town people would honour an important person by going outside the village or the town to welcome them and escort them into the town. In the 1960s, Egypt had a president, President Nasser, very well loved by the people. And one day he was going to a place called Assuit, in kind of the south of Egypt. The people met him. They walked from the town and met him 10 miles outside the town, just to show how much they honoured him. So imagine, we've got a visitor, and we all walk from here over to Torquay to meet them. But they did something else. They'd taken large ropes with them, and they tied them round the bumpers of the car, and they pulled him for 10 miles into the town. For them, it was the highest honour they could show to anybody. And this is some of the culture of the Middle East, of welcoming people to come in. What would have happened? They would have arranged hospitality for him, place to stay, place to eat, place to, you know, clean up and everything else. And so here we have Jesus being welcomed by a crowd outside Jericho, and they're walking in with him. So I wouldn't say, but you can assume maybe they've been saying, "Jesus is coming, let's get something ready to welcome him." I would think it's pretty good that possibly that did happen. So Jesus is passing by. And so suddenly, outside the city, this beggar starts saying, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." We're told that the crowd told him to be quiet. Apparently, the strength of that word used is shut your mouth. Stop it. Who do you think you are? Be quiet. Keep out of this. But that actually incensed him, so he shouted even louder, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus heard. And Jesus stopped the procession. And what he did, he said to the ones who'd been telling the blind beggar to be quiet, he said, "You bring him forward." So he used those who were trying to stop him, who were actually oppressing him, to bring him into his presence. We don't know the beggar's name from the reading we just done, but actually, we do find out from Mark, I think it is, that he's called Bartimaeus. Literal translation of that name is son of filth, or son of unclean. What title you would carry with you all your days? You're the son of filth, or you're the son of unclean. Doesn't go well for you, does it? So here's Bartimaeus, and he's shouting out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And they tell him to be quiet, but then he's brought into the presence of Jesus. So Jesus, and I did mention this a couple of weeks ago as well, didn't I? He stands before Jesus, this blind beggar, and Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" You know, some say, is that insensitive? Is that a bit hard? You know, wouldn't you nobody needed. But actually, maybe we can unpack this a little bit, because how Jesus sometimes seems hard, but sometimes his reason behind why he does it. In the Middle Eastern culture at the time, beggars were seen to have a purpose. You see, every honourable person was supposed to give to the poor. That's what you're supposed to do. Pious Jew, give to the poor. So the beggar served a purpose. Because if they didn't see these poor people, how could they fulfil the law that said, give to the poor? So the attitude of the beggar was a bit different than sometimes we have now, where they just shake the can and they look so down. They could be quite bolshy, I was going to say. They could be quite, not aggressive, but let me just read some of the things that they could do. He said he didn't put on a weak voice. He wouldn't plead for a few coins for bread. No, he speaks out boldly. And he challenges the passerby to give to God. Give to God. Fulfill your duty. Don't look at what I need. Look what God's asking you to do. Give to me. I'm doing you a favor. You give to me now and everyone's going to see it. Everyone's going to know you've given to me. That's going to be good for you. And when he does give, he don't just say thank you. He kind of stands up and say, I pray blessing on this man who's just given to me. He's fulfilled what God's asked him to do. What a great and honourable man he is. I pray blessing over your house. And it was like he was doing all this. Who wouldn't want that kind of publicity? Who wouldn't? So they did have a place. But Jesus also knew something else. He knew that if the man had been begging all his life, the possibility was he had no deep educational understandings, not trained for a job. How would he get by? What could he do? So maybe Jesus is asking, look, in your interest, what do you want me to do? And the question could be, will you be able to cope with the new life if you can see? Think about it. So often we ask God for things, and we don't always understand the cost it will be for us to receive those things, not just to be given. What do we do now? How do we live now? There's challenges, different challenges if we're healed than we had before. And maybe that's what Jesus was saying to the blind man, to Bartimaeus. Grace might be free from Jesus, but it's never cheap. And when I was thinking about this, when we become Christians, it costs. We think it costs us nothing, but it does. Because suddenly you're going to live a different way, a different life than you did yesterday. You might have to stop doing things that you were doing yesterday. You might have to have different thoughts. You might have to finish with certain practices and friends that you know are not right anymore. Or maybe I can't do that anymore. I mean, the Bible's quite clear about how much we should drink, about sexual things, about marriage and purity in marriage, about what we watch, what we read. No more stealing. No more kind of pilfering a bit of time from the boss, or, oh, I just need another pencil, or just take that one home, nobody minds. Do you know, little things. Suddenly we're different. We have to be different. So it costs. We might be saved, but now we have to live it out and be different. And maybe that's what Jesus was saying. So he says, what do you want me to do? And the beggar says, I want to see. I want my sight. But up to now he's been saying, Jesus, son of David. Now he suddenly says, Lord, I want to see. He's changed. Son of David was, a generic title for Jesus. But this beggar's now saying, I've gone from there, now you're Lord, my Lord. And Jesus heals him. And he says this to the beggar. He says, about your faith's healed you. But what faith did the beggar show? He obviously believed Jesus could heal. He He obviously believed Jesus would have compassion to heal. And if he could only get to him, he would answer his prayer. But how did the crowd respond? How did they respond to this blind beggar, Bartimaeus, initially? Keep quiet, stay away. In a sense, by telling the leaders to bring him, he was telling them off the hardness of heart. They tried to keep somebody away from him. They wanted to isolate him. Jesus wanted to bring him forward. So in a sense, the beggar had been oppressed by the community. So in a sense, they had become the oppressor. But Jesus extends grace to the beggar who the crowd had rejected. Now, could the crowd overcome the rebuke that they'd had from Jesus? Could they join in thanks for the healing of the man? Well, we know the story. As soon as the man received his sight, he went away leaping, rejoicing. And it does say the crowd also praised God for what they'd seen. So even though, in a sense, he'd had their knuckles wrapped, they saw the miracle before their own eyes and knew this was none other than the grace of God. So as long as Jesus is offering special grace to the oppressed, the crowd will go along with it, even when they've got it wrong. What about grace when it's offered to an oppressor? On the same day, Jesus is now on his way through. He's leaving. I would think the townspeople would want him to stay. They might be a little bit upset with him because he's not staying. But now he's on his way. Because if you read earlier, he's actually on his way to Jerusalem. He's on the way to Passover, onto the day when he's going to ride into Jerusalem. That's it. It's fixed. It's fixed. He's got to do it. He's keeping on. But now we can read from Luke 19, the first 10 verses. Same day, I believe. Jesus had entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. And they began to mutter, "He's gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anyone out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." And the oppressor and the oppressed are both lost. The phrase, as I mentioned earlier, passing through, showed that Jesus didn't intend to stay in Jericho. They might have made arrangements for him, but he said, "No, I'm going. I'm leaving." Bear that in mind. But Zacchaeus suddenly appears on the scene, and we're told several things about him straight away. First of all, he was a tax collector. He's also very rich and very small. Tax collectors were despised in rabbinic teachings. New Testament doesn't have many good things to say about them. They got rich at other people's expense. They were considered unclean. You could lie to a tax collector because they were nothing. They won't be part of the normal community because they cheated. Roman collaborators. not a very nice opinion of them at all. But we're told that Zacchaeus wanted to see Jesus. But because the crowd was so large and he was short, he needed to get a good vantage point. Now, if he'd been a good rich man, the crowd might have let him through to see. But he wasn't a good rich man. And in fact, those days were quite violent. You had the zealots. If he got himself lost in a crowd, it would be quite easy. Somebody could take a knife out, and that would be the end of Zacchaeus. He were hated. So here he is. What can he do? So he runs. And he finds a sycamore fig tree. First, for a rich man to run is quite humiliating. To climb a tree is another thing. I'm going to tell you something you might not know. Ben might have done this in his research, because Ben years, some time ago, worked for the council preserving trees. That was part of his job before he's got his new job. So he might know this bylaw. But you couldn't plant a sycamore fig tree within 25 yards of a city wall or the extremity of the city. It had to be at least 25 yards away. So it has to be outside the town. Did you know that one, Ben? It's one of the planning laws they had. 25 yards away. Sycamore fig trees had long branches, easy to climb, thick foliage. Now, I could imagine in those days they had walled cities for protection. So imagine having a tree like that right outside the wall where the branches could go up to the height of the wall, easy to climb, easy to hide in. It wouldn't make any sense, would it? So I can understand why maybe they couldn't be built within 25 yards. So it shows this is now outside the city and they're all going. So Jesus walks along and stops at the sycamore fig tree and he sees the man. And he calls to him, Zacchaeus, come on down. So maybe the townspeople are already a bit disgruntled because Jesus isn't stopping with them. And then suddenly they see this little man in the tree who Jesus by name calls down. And suddenly they realize who it is. A tax collector. Can I put a perspective on this? He'd stolen the money from them. He'd taken money that he shouldn't have done, and he had the protection of Rome to do it. In those days, if you couldn't pay debts, your children could be sold. You could be sold into slavery. If you don't pay your bills, you can be sold. So it wasn't, oh, it's just taken a bit, it's just a bit harder to live now. Maybe they hadn't enough money to live. And they could see him getting richer and richer, but they had nothing. So you could understand why there might be hatred shown to this tax collector. So can you imagine now a crowd? Zacchaeus is there. Jesus has called him by name and he says, Zacchaeus, I'm going to come and stay with you today. In a sense, he'd refused the crowd. He'd refused to stay with them. What do you think their feelings would be? Oh, that's a lovely thing to do. Oh, how nice. I think what the people were expecting Jesus to say is something like, you dirty, cheating collaborator, get down from the tree. What right have you to hurt all these people? Look at them, the ones you've oppressed, you've stolen from them. You're a disgrace to the nation, you're a disgrace to God. Get down here, I'm going to sort you out. And if he'd said that, they would have stood and clapped. Years ago, there was a story. Most of you know the parable of what we would call the prodigal son. There was an open-air theatre putting on the production. I think it was a church thing. And they came to the part where the son came home. And they changed the words in this, obviously. And the son comes home and comes to his father and says, Father, I'm sorry, I've sinned against you and before heaven. What do you think you're doing running back here to me? Squandered my money, made me a laughing stock in the area, myself and your brother. Now you've wasted all. You come here with your tail between your legs and you want me to help you? And somebody from the crowd shouted, that's exactly as it should have been. So So Jesus didn't do what the crowd thought he should have done. So he chooses an oppressor to give him a meal. Now, in that culture again, to eat with somebody means you accept them. Far more to having a meal than just satisfying hunger. There's a social thing that says, I'm eating because I accept you. So actually, to the community, it would be like Jesus was rejecting them and putting the oppressor above them. What Jesus was doing suddenly took the hostility from Zacchaeus, and he became the one to take the hostility, because they began to blame him. He put himself in the way. Bear in mind, we've not heard one word from Zacchaeus at this point. Not yet. In the story of the beggar, there is initial hostility against the beggar. But when Jesus gives grace, that all changes. But in this story, the hostility towards Zacchaeus is changed when Jesus extends amazing love and grace to him. And Jesus becomes the butt of all the aggression and the hostility. What an example of what he did only a few weeks later, days even, when he died on the cross and he took God's hostility and wrath against sinful people and he stood in the middle so that we didn't have to bear it. What a testimony. He took it from Zacchaeus and he became in the middle. What an awesome thing. Costly grace and love poured out on an oppressor. Can I just leave the story there? I want to read you a few scriptures. Those are just one-liners. Matthew 5:44. I'm going to read you this scripture in three different ways. But I tell you, Jesus speaking, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Another translation puts it, but I say to you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which spitefully use you and persecute you. And I came across this one. It's from the Aramaic Bible in plain English, and it says, but I say to you, love your enemies, bless the ones who curse you, and do what is beautiful to the one who hates you. And pray over those who take you by force and persecute you. How many Christians today are taken by force and are persecuted? And we have the testimony how they prayed for their torturers and they prayed for their persecutors. There's even stories where people about to be executed, Christians, forgave their executioner. Luke 6:27-28 says also on similar lines, but I find this bit, for those who will listen, that's how it begins, but for those who listen, I say, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Are we willing to listen to that? Because it's an implication that some people won't listen. But Jesus said, for those who will listen. Luke 23:34, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And then they divided his clothes among them, casting lots. And Stephen, Acts 7:60, falling on his knees, cried out in a loud voice, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. And when he had said this, he fell asleep He didn't actually fall asleep. He did, but they just stoned him to death. But he could forgive even as they were killing him. Jesus could forgive those who were nailing him to the cross. Romans 12:14, bless those who persecute you. Bless, don't curse. Do we find that easy? Romans 12:20, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you'll heap burning coals on his head. And I think the one that sums everything up is John 13, verse 34. A new commandment I give you. Love one another. As I have loved you, so also love one another. Can I say it's a new commandment? I said before, it's not a new suggestion. It's not a good idea. It's a new commandment. And the word they translate there is agape love. It's not filial love. It's not brotherly love. It's one that goes above and beyond. And that's what Jesus was doing with Zacchaeus. And isn't that what we're called to do? What about people? None of this is easy. People who've suffered marriage or marriage breakdowns. How is it to forgive the one that's done stuff or both sides, whatever? Remember years ago, there was a book by a man called Harold Herbeley. And it was about two becoming one, about marriage. And he said, when some couples are getting together, we've all got weaknesses, but you cover them. You don't notice them. You overlook them, you know. But suddenly when things are pulling apart, the things that were weaknesses and you covered before now becomes a target. And that's what you aim for. But aren't we called to forgive? I know there's been many women had to forgive sexual abuse by their fathers. We've done it. And what they found is it brings freedom to them, as well as the person who did it. Their freedom. It's not easy, some of these things. This is not saying that it's right. You know, what's been done to you is right. But it's saying there's a power of forgiveness that can even overshadow that and bring you freedom. This is what Jesus was showing to Zacchaeus. Not easy. Not saying they deserve forgiveness. But then do we? Did we deserve forgiveness from God? Did we? Do we still, in a sense? Because we all still get things wrong, don't we? We're holy but being made holy. Always have to remember that, I think. When we choose not to forgive, we actually hurt ourselves. And we tie ourselves up. Could be in family relationships, you know. Did a funeral a couple of weeks ago and asking the people, are those becoming to the family? I think it was a son. No, there's a bit of problem in the family there, so they probably won't. What a shame, isn't it? You know, we hurt ourselves when we don't forgive. And it's not that is not condoning. It's bringing freedom. So just to finish now. So Zacchaeus, Jesus goes home, has a meal with him. And Zacchaeus is wonderfully saved. He's going to give 10 times back or whatever, 4 times as much. Okay, so he stands up and Jesus said, salvation's come to this house, for this man also is a son of Abraham. But when would the crowd know it was real? Not just because Jesus had just said it. I think the crowd would know it's real when Zacchaeus did what he'd said. He had to gain their trust. And he had to pay back. And they had to see a change in his life. Now, same for us. We can say what we like. But actually always people, they see what you're doing. And that takes preference over what you say. Always. You have to earn people's trust. So both these men, Bartimaeus and Zacchaeus, have been recipients of unmerited love and grace and favor. And their lives will never be the same. The communities acted differently, but that's what we happen today, doesn't it? Different people respond in different way. Zacchaeus didn't need to be given a set of rules. The response he made came from his heart when it was filled with the unconditional love of Jesus. He was beginning from where he was, not from where the crowd thought he should be. Jesus finds us as we are. The only thing that Zacchaeus did, actually, we don't hear any formal repentance whatsoever, apart from the end, I will give back. But he came looking. He wanted to see Jesus. And in a sense, he put himself out there. He became findable, almost, if you know what I mean. He put himself out there because he wanted to see Jesus. And their lives were never the same again. And actually, I think the community's lives were never the same either, because they saw the difference. So that scripture, again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And we know that Jesus came to bring comfort to not only the oppressed, but the oppressor, so he could find them both. And when I talked earlier about we need also to forgive, can we trust God enough not to lean on our own understandings in all of this and say, they deserve it. Trust that as we do it God's way, that he will bring healing and freedom, and he'll make our path straight. Shall we pray?